care in the world. That the whole of contemporary history, the world wars, the war of dreams, the man on the moon, science, literature, philosophy, the pursuit of knowledge, was no more than a blink of the Earth woman's eye. And we, my dears, everything we are and ever will be are just a twinkle in her eye, Charco said grandly, lying on his bed, staring at the ceiling. When he was in this sort of mood, Charco used his reading aloud voice. His room had a church feeling. He didn't care whether anyone was listening to him or not, and if they were, he didn't care whether or not they had understood what he was saying. Amu called them his Oxford moods. Later, in the light of all that happened, twinkle seemed completely the wrong word to describe the expression in the Earth woman's eye. Twinkle was a word with crinkled, happy edges. Though the Earth woman made a lasting impression on the twins, it was the history house, so much closer at hand, that really fascinated them. They thought about it often. The house on the other side of the river, looming in the heart of darkness. A house they couldn't enter, full of whispers they couldn't understand. They didn't know then that soon they would go in, that they would cross the river and be where they weren't supposed to be, with a man they weren't supposed to love. That they would watch with dinner plate eyes as history revealed itself to them in the back veranda. While other children of their age learned other things, Esther and Rahel learned how history negotiates its terms and collects its dues from those who break its laws. They heard its sickening thud. They smelled its smell and never forgot it. History's smell, like old roses on a breeze. It would lurk forever in ordinary things, in coat hangers, tomatoes, in the tar on roads, in certain colors, in the plates at a restaurant, in the absence of words, and the emptiness in eyes. They would grow up grappling with ways of living with what had happened. They would try to tell themselves that in terms of geological time, it was an insignificant event, just a blink of the Earth woman's eye, that worse things had happened, that worse things kept happening. But they would find no comfort in the thought. Charco said that going to see The Sound of Music was an extended exercise in Anglophilia. Amu said, "Oh, come on, the whole world goes to see The Sound of Music. It's a world hit." "Nevertheless, my dear," Charco said in his reading aloud voice, "never the less." Mamachi often said that Charco was easily one of the cleverest men in India. "According to whom?" Amu would say. "On what basis?" Mamachi loved to tell the story, Charco's story, of how one of the dons at Oxford had said that in his opinion, Charco was brilliant and made of prime ministerial material. To this, Amu always said, "ha, ha, ha," like people in the comics. She said, A, going to Oxford didn't necessarily make a person clever. B, cleverness didn't necessarily make a good prime minister. C. If a person couldn't even run a pickle factory profitably, how was that person going to run a whole country? And most important of all, D. All Indian mothers are obsessed with their sons and are therefore poor judges of their abilities. Charco said, A. You don't go to Oxford, you read at Oxford. And B. After reading at Oxford, you come down. Down to earth, do you mean? Amu would ask. That you definitely do, like your famous airplanes. Amu said that the sad but entirely predictable fate of Charco's airplanes was an impartial measure of his abilities. Once a month, except during the monsoons, a parcel would arrive for Charco by VPP. It always contained a Balsa-era modeling kit. It usually took Charco between 8 and 10 days to assemble the aircraft with its tiny fuel tank and motorized propeller. When it was ready, he would take Esther and Rahel to the rice fields in Nartagam to help him fly it. It never flew for more than a minute. Month after month, Chaco's carefully constructed planes crashed in the slush-green paddy fields, into which Esther and Rahel would spurt like trained retrievers to salvage the remains. A tail, a tank, a wing, a wounded machine. Chaco's room was cluttered with broken wooden planes, and every month another kit would arrive. Chaco never blamed the crashes on the kit. It was only after Papaji died that Chaco resigned his job as lecturer at the Madras Christian College and came to Imanam with his Balliol ore and his pickle baron dreams. He commuted his pension and provident fund to buy a Bharat bottle sealing machine. His ore, with his teammates' names inscribed in gold, hung from iron hoops on the factory wall. Up to the time Chaco arrived, the factory had been a small but profitable enterprise. Mamachi just ran it like a large kitchen. Chaco had it registered as a partnership and informed Mamachi that she was the sleeping partner. He invested in equipment, canning machines, cauldrons, cookers, and expanded the labor force. Almost immediately, the financial slide began, but was artificially buoyed by extravagant bank loans that Chaco raised by mortgaging the family's rice fields around the Imanam house. Though Ammu did as much work in the factory as Chaco, whenever he was dealing with food inspectors or sanitary engineers, he always referred to it as my factory, my pineapples, my pickles. Legally, this was the case because Ammu, as a daughter, had no claim to the property. Chaco told Rahel and Esther that Ammu had no locusts stand I. Thanks to our wonderful male chauvinist society, Ammu said. Chaco said, what's yours is mine, and what's mine is also mine. He had a surprisingly high laugh for a man of his size and fatness, and when he laughed, he shook all over without appearing to move. Until Chaco arrived in Imanam, Mamachi's factory had no name. Everybody just referred to her pickles and jams as Shosha's tender mango or Shosha's banana jam. Shosha was Mamachi's first name, Shoshama. It was Chaco who christened the factory Paradise Pickles and Preserves and had labels designed and printed at Comrade K&M Pillay's Press. At first, he had wanted to call it Zeus Pickles and Preserves. But that idea was vetoed because everybody said that Zeus was too obscure and had no local relevance, whereas Paradise did. Comrade Pillay's suggestion, Parashuram Pickles, was vetoed for the opposite reason, too much local relevance. It was Chakwa's idea to have a billboard painted and installed on the Plymouth's roof rack. Now, on the way to Cochin, it rattled and made falling off noises. Near Wycombe, they had to stop and buy some rope to secure it more firmly. That delayed them by another 20 minutes. Rahel began to worry about being late for the Sound of Music. Then, as they approached the outskirts of Cochin, the red and white arm of the railway level crossing gate went down. Rahel knew that this had happened because she had been hoping that it wouldn't. She hadn't learned to control her hopes yet. Esther said that was a bad sign. So now they were going to miss the beginning of the picture, when Julie Andrews starts off as a speck on the hill and gets bigger and bigger till she bursts onto the screen with her voice like cold water and her breath like peppermint. The red sign on the red and white arm said, stop, in white. Pots, Rahel said. A yellow hoarding said, be Indian, buy Indian, in red. Naidni Yub, Naidni Eb, Esther said. The twins were precocious with their reading. They had raced through Old Dog Tom, Janet and John, and their Ronald Ridout workbooks. At night, Ammu read to them from Kipling's Jungle Book. Now Cheel the kite brings home the night that Mang the bat sets free. The down on their arms would stand on end, golden in the light of the bedside lamp. As she read, Ammu could make her voice gravelly like Sher Khan's, or whining like Tabaki's. Ye choose and ye do not choose. What talk is this of choosing? By the bull that I killed, am I to stand nosing into your dog's den for my fair dues? It is I, Shere Khan, who speak. And it is I, Raksha, who answer, the twins would shout in high voices, not together, but almost. The man's cub is mine, Lungri, mine to me. He shall not be killed. He shall live to run with the pack and to hunt with the pack, and in the end, look you, hunter of little naked cubs, frog-eater, fish-killer, he shall hunt thee.
Baby Kuchma, who had been put in charge of their formal education, had read them an abridged version of The Tempest by Charles and Mary Lamb. Where the bee sucks, there suck I, Esther and Rahel would go about saying, in a cowslip's bell I lie. So when Baby Kuchma's Australian missionary friend, Miss Mitten, gave Esther and Rahel a baby book, The Adventures of Susie Squirrel, as a present when she visited Imanam, they were deeply offended. First, they read it forward. Miss Mitten, who belonged to a sect of born-again Christians, said that she was a little disappointed in them when they read it aloud to her backwards. Ehet srut nevda fo aisus liriux, ino gnerps gninrom aisus liriux ekopu. They showed Miss Mitten how it was possible to read both Malayalam and Madam I am Adam backwards as well as forwards. She wasn't amused, and it turned out that she didn't even know what Malayalam was. They told her it was the language everyone spoke in Kerala. She said she had been under the impression that it was called Keralese. Esther, who had by then taken an active dislike to Miss Mitten, told her that as far as he was concerned, it was a highly stupid impression. Miss Mitten complained to Baby Kuchma about Esther's rudeness and about their reading backwards. She told Baby Kuchma that she had seen Satan in their eyes. Natas ni reht say. They were made to write, in future we will not read backwards. In future we will not read backwards. 100 times. Forwards. A few months later, Miss Mitten was killed by a milk van in Hobart, across the road from a cricket oval. To the twins, there was hidden justice in the fact that the milk van had been reversing. More buses and cars had stopped on either side of the level crossing. An ambulance that said Sacred Heart Hospital was full of a party of people on their way to a wedding. The bride was staring out of the back window, her face partially obscured by the flaking paint of the huge red cross. The buses all had girls' names. Lucy Kutti, Molly Kutti, Beena Mol. In Malayalam, Mol is little girl and Mon is little boy. Beena Mol was full of pilgrims who'd had their heads shaved at Tirupati. Rahel could see a row of bald heads at the bus window, above evenly spaced vomit streaks. She was more than a little curious about vomiting. She had never vomited, not once. Esther had, and when he did, his skin grew hot and shiny, and his eyes helpless and beautiful, and Ammu loved him more than usual. Chako said that Esther and Rahel were indecently healthy, and so was Sophie Moore. He said it was because they didn't suffer from inbreeding like most Syrian Christians and Parsis. Mamachi said that what her grandchildren suffered from was far worse than inbreeding. She meant having parents who were divorced. As though these were the only choices available to people, inbreeding or divorce. Rahel wasn't sure what she suffered from, but occasionally she practiced sad faces and sighing in the mirror. It is a far, far better thing that I do than I have ever done, she would say to herself sadly. That was Rahel being Sidney Carton, being Charles Darnay, as he stood on the steps, waiting to be guillotined, in the Classics Illustrated Comics version of A Tale of Two Cities. She wondered what had caused the bald pilgrims to vomit so uniformly, and whether they had vomited together in a single, well-orchestrated heave, to music perhaps, to the rhythm of a bus bhajan,
or separately, one at a time. Initially, when the level crossing had just closed, the air was full of the impatient sound of idling engines. But when the man that manned the crossing came out of his booth on his backwards bending legs and signaled, with his limp, flapping walk to the tea stall, that they were in for a long wait, drivers switched off their engines and milled about, stretching their legs. With a desultory nod of his bored and sleepy head, the level-crossing divinity conjured up beggars with bandages, men with trays selling pieces of fresh coconut, parupuvaras on banana leaves, and cold drinks, Coca-Cola, Fanta, rose milk. A leper with soiled bandages begged at the car window.
"That looks like mercurochrome to me," Amu said of his inordinately bright blood.
"Congratulations," Chaku said, "spoken like a true bourgeoise." Amu smiled, and they shook hands, as though she really was being awarded a certificate of merit for being an honest-to-goodness, genuine bourgeoise. Moments like these the twins treasured and threaded like precious beads on a somewhat scanty necklace. Rahel and Esther squashed their noses against the Plymouth's quarter windows, yearning marshmallows with cloudy children behind them. Amu said no, firmly and with conviction. Chaco lit a Charminar. He inhaled deeply and then removed a little flake of tobacco that had stayed behind on his tongue. Inside the Plymouth, it wasn't easy for Rahel to see Esther because baby Gachma rose between them like a hill. Amu had insisted that they sit separately to prevent them from fighting. When they fought, Esther called Rahel a refugee stick insect. Rahel called him Elvis the Pelvis and did a twisty, fanny kind of dance that infuriated Esther. When they had serious physical fights, they were so evenly matched that the fights went on forever, and things that came in their way, table lamps, ashtrays, and water jugs, were smashed or irreparably damaged. Baby Kuchma was holding on to the back of the front seat with her arms. When the car moved, her arm fat swung like heavy washing in the wind. Now it hung down like a fleshy curtain, blocking Esther from Rahel. On Esther's side of the road was a tea shack that sold tea and stale glucose biscuits in dim glass cases with flies. There was lemon soda in thick bottles with blue marble stoppers to keep the fizz in, and a red icebox that said, rather sadly, "Things go better with Coca-Cola." Muralidharan, the level-crossing lunatic, perched cross-legged and perfectly balanced on the milestone. His balls and penis dangled down, pointing towards the sign which said, "Cochin, 23 kilometers." Muralidharan was naked, except for the tall plastic bag that somebody had fitted onto his head like a transparent chef's cap, through which the view of the landscape continued, dimmed, chef-shaped, but uninterrupted. He couldn't remove his cap, even if he had wanted to, because he had no arms. They had been blown off in Singapore in 42, within the first week of his running away from home to join the fighting ranks of the Indian National Army. After independence, he had himself registered as a Grade 1 freedom fighter and had been allotted a free first-class railway pass for life. This, too, he had lost, along with his mind. So he could no longer live on trains or in refreshment rooms in railway stations. Muralidharan had no home, no doors to lock, but he had his old keys tied carefully around his waist, in a shining bunch. His mind was full of cupboards, cluttered with secret pleasures. An alarm clock, a red car with a musical horn, a red mug for the bathroom, a wife with a diamond, a briefcase with important papers, a coming home from the office, and, "I'm sorry, Colonel Sabhapati, but I'm afraid I've said my say," and crisp banana chips for the children. He watched the trains come and go. He counted his keys. He watched governments rise and fall. He counted his keys. He watched cloudy children at car windows with yearning marshmallow noses. The homeless, the helpless, the sick, the small and lost,
all filed past his window. Still, he counted his keys. He was never sure which cupboard he might have to open or when. He sat on the burning milestone with his matted hair and eyes like windows, and was glad to be able to look away sometimes, to have his keys to count and counter-check. Numbers would do. Numbness would be fine. Muralidharan moved his mouth when he counted and made well-formed words. Onna, randa, moona. Esther noticed that the hair on his head was curly grey, the hair in his windy, armless armpits was wispy black, and the hair in his crotch was black and springy. One man with three kinds of hair. Esther wondered how that could be. He tried to think of whom to ask. The waiting filled Rahel until she was ready to burst. She looked at her watch. It was 10 to 2. She thought of Julie Andrews and Christopher Plummer kissing each other sideways so that their noses didn't collide. She wondered whether people always kissed each other sideways. She tried to think of whom to ask. Then, from a distance, a hum approached the held-up traffic and covered it like a cloak. The drivers who'd been stretching their legs got back into their vehicles and slammed doors. The beggars and vendors disappeared. Within minutes, there was no one on the road. Except Muralidharan, perched with his bum on the burning milestone, unperturbed, and only mildly curious. There was hustle-bustle and police whistles. From behind the line of waiting, oncoming traffic, a column of men appeared, with red flags and banners and a hum that grew and grew. "Put up your windows," Chako said, "and stay calm. They're not going to hurt us." "Why not join them, comrade?" Amu said to Chako. "I'll drive." Chako said nothing. A muscle tensed below the wad of fat on his jaw. He tossed away his cigarette and rolled up his window. Chako was a self-proclaimed Marxist. He would call pretty women who worked in the factory to his room, and on the pretext of lecturing them on labor rights and trade union law, flirt with them outrageously. He would call them comrade, and insist that they call him comrade back, which made them giggle. Much to their embarrassment and Mamachi's dismay, he forced them to sit at table with him and drink tea. Once he even took a group of them to attend trade union classes that were held in Alapi. They went by bus and returned by boat. They came back happy, with glass bangles and flowers in their hair. Amu said it was all hogwash. Just a case of a spoiled princeling playing comrade, comrade. An Oxford avatar of the old zamindar mentality, a landlord forcing his attentions on women who depended on him for their livelihood. As the marchers approached, Amu put up her window, Esther his, Rahel hers, effortfully because the black knob on the handle had fallen off. Suddenly, the sky-blue Plymouth looked absurdly opulent on the narrow, pitted road, like a wide lady squeezing down a narrow corridor, like Baby Kuchma in church, on her way to the bread and wine. "Look down," Baby Kuchma said, as the front ranks of the procession approached the car. "Avoid eye contact, that's what really provokes them." On the side of her neck, her pulse was pounding. Within minutes, the road was swamped by thousands of marching people, automobile islands in a river of people. The air was red with flags, which dipped and lifted as the marchers ducked under the level crossing gate and swept across the railway tracks in a red wave. The sound of 1,000 voices spread over the frozen traffic like a noise umbrella.
Inkolab Zindabad, Torilali Ekta Zindabad.
Long live the revolution, they shouted. Workers of the world, unite. Even Chako had no really complete explanation for why the Communist Party was so much more successful in Kerala than it had been almost anywhere else in India, except perhaps in West Bengal. There were several competing theories. One was that it had to do with the large population of Christians in the state. 20% of Kerala's population were Syrian Christians, who believed that they were descendants of the 100 Brahmins whom St. Thomas the Apostle converted to Christianity when he traveled east after the resurrection. Structurally, this somewhat rudimentary argument went, Marxism was a simple substitute for Christianity. Replace God with Marx, Satan with the bourgeoisie, heaven with a classless society, the church with the party, and the form and purpose of the journey remained similar. An obstacle race, with a prize at the end. Whereas the Hindu mind had to make more complex adjustments. The trouble with this theory was that in Kerala, the Syrian Christians were, by and large, the wealthy, estate-owning, pickle-factory-running feudal lords, for whom communism represented a fate worse than death. They had always voted for the Congress Party. A second theory claimed that it had to do with a comparatively high level of literacy in the state. Perhaps. Except that the high literacy level was largely because of the communist movement. The real secret was that communism crept into Kerala insidiously, as a reformist movement that never overtly questioned the traditional values of a caste-ridden, extremely traditional community. The Marxists worked from within the communal divides, never challenging them, never appearing not to. They offered a cocktail revolution, a heady mix of Eastern Marxism and Orthodox Hinduism, spiked with a shot of democracy. Though Chako was not a card-holding member of the party, he had been converted early and had remained, through all its travails, a committed supporter. He was an undergraduate at Delhi University during the euphoria of 1957, when the communists won the state assembly elections and Nehru invited them to form a government. Chako's hero, Comrade E.M.S. Nambudripad, the flamboyant Brahmin high priest of Marxism in Kerala, became chief minister of the first ever democratically elected communist government in the world. Suddenly, the communists found themselves in the extraordinary, critics said absurd, position of having to govern a people and foment revolution simultaneously. Comrade E.M.S. Nambudripad evolved his own theory about how he would do this. Chako studied his treatise on the peaceful transition to communism with an adolescent's obsessive diligence and an ardent fan's unquestioning approval. It set out in detail how Comrade E.M.S. Nambudripad's government intended to enforce land reforms, neutralize the police, subvert the judiciary, and restrain the hand of the reactionary anti-people Congress government at the center. Unfortunately, before the year was out, the peaceful part of the peaceful transition came to an end. Every morning at breakfast, the imperial entomologist derided his argumentative Marxist son by reading out newspaper reports of the riots, strikes, and incidents of police brutality that convulsed Kerala. "So, Karl Marx," Papachi would sneer when Chako came to the table, "what shall we do with these bloody students now? The stupid goons are agitating against our people's government. Shall we annihilate them? Surely students aren't people anymore." Over the next 2 years, the political discord, fueled by the Congress Party and the church, slid into anarchy. By the time Chako finished his BA and left for Oxford to do another one, Kerala was on the brink of civil war. Nehru dismissed the communist government and announced fresh elections. The Congress Party returned to power. It was only in 1967, almost exactly 10 years after they first came to power, that Comrade E.M.S. Nambudripad's party was re-elected, this time as part of a coalition between what had by now become two separate parties, the Communist Party of India and the Communist Party of India Marxist, the CPI and the CPIM. Papachi was dead by then. Chako divorced. Paradise Pickles was 7 years old. Kerala was reeling in the aftermath of famine and a failed monsoon. People were dying. Hunger had to be very high up on any government list of priorities. During his second term in office, Comrade EMS went about implementing the peaceful transition more soberly. This earned him the wrath of the Chinese Communist Party. They denounced him for his parliamentary cretinism and accused him of providing relief to the people and thereby blunting the people's consciousness and diverting them from the revolution. Peking switched its patronage to the newest, most militant faction of the CPIM, the Naxalites, who had staged an armed insurrection in Naxalbari, a village in Bengal. They organized peasants into fighting cadres, seized land, expelled the owners, and established people's courts to try class enemies. The Naxalite movement spread across the country and struck terror in every bourgeois heart. In Kerala, they breathed a plume of excitement and fear into the already frightened air. Killings had begun in the north. That May, there was a blurred photograph in the papers of a landlord in Palghat who had been tied to a lamppost and beheaded. His head lay on its side, some distance away from his body, in a dark puddle that could have been water, could have been blood. It was hard to tell in black and white, in the grey, pre-dawn light. His surprised eyes were open. Comrade EMS Nambudripad, running dog, Soviet stooge, expelled the Naxalites from his party and went on with the business of harnessing anger for parliamentary purposes. The march that surged around the sky-blue Plymouth on that sky-blue December day was a part of that process. It had been organized by the Travancore Cochin Marxist Labour Union. Their comrades in Trivandrum would march to the Secretariat and present the Charter of People's Demands to Comrade EMS himself. The orchestra petitioning its conductor. Their demands were that paddy workers who were made to work in the fields for 11.5 hours a day, from 7 in the morning to 6:30 in the evening, be permitted to take a 1-hour lunch break. That women's wages be increased from 1 rupee 25 paisa a day to 3 rupees, and men's from 2 rupees 50 paisa to 4 rupees 50 paisa a day. They were also demanding that untouchables no longer be addressed by their caste names. They demanded not to be addressed as Achu Parayan, or Kelan Paravan, or Kutten Polayan, but just as Achu, or Kelan, or Kutten. Cardamom kings, coffee counts, and rubber barons, old boarding school buddies, came down from their lonely, far-flung estates and sipped chilled beer at the sailing club. They raised their glasses. "A rose by any other name," they said, and sniggered to hide their rising panic. The marchers that day were party workers, students, and the laborers themselves, touchables and untouchables. On their shoulders they carried a keg of ancient anger, lit with a recent fuse. There was an edge to this anger that was Naxalite and new. Through the Plymouth window, Rahel could see that the loudest word they said was Zindabad, and that the veins stood out in their necks when they said it, and that the arms that held the flags and banners were knotted and hard. Inside the Plymouth, it was still and hot. Baby Kuchma's fear lay rolled up on the car floor like a damp, clammy cheroot. This was just the beginning of it. The fear that over the years would grow to consume her, that would make her lock her doors and windows, that would give her 2 hairlines, and both her mouths. Hers too was an ancient, age-old fear, the fear of being dispossessed. She tried to count the green beads on her rosary but couldn't concentrate. An open hand slammed against the car window. A bald fist banged down on the burning sky-blue bonnet. It sprang open. The Plymouth looked like an angular blue animal in a zoo, asking to be fed. A bun. A banana. Another bald fist slammed down on it, and the bonnet closed. Chako rolled down his window and called out to the man who had done it.
"Thanks, Keto," he said. "Valare thanks."
"Don't be so ingratiating, comrade," Amu said. "It was an accident. He didn't really mean to help.
How could he possibly know that in this old car there beats a truly Marxist heart?
Amu, Chako said, his voice steady and deliberately casual. Is it at all possible for you to prevent your washed-up cynicism from completely coloring everything?
Silence filled the car like a saturated sponge. Washed up, cut like a knife through a soft thing. The sun shone with a shuddering sigh. This was the trouble with families. Like invidious doctors, they knew just where it hurt.
Just then, Rahel saw Velita, Velyapapan's son, Velita, her most beloved friend, Velita. Velita marching with a red flag, in a white shirt and munda, with angry veins in his neck. He never usually wore a shirt. Rahel rolled down her window in a flash. Velita, Velita, she called to him. He froze for a moment and listened with his flag. What he had heard was a familiar voice in a most unfamiliar circumstance. Rahel, standing on the car seat, had grown out of the Plymouth window like the loose, flailing horn of a car-shaped herbivore, with a fountain in a love in Tokyo and yellow-rimmed red plastic sunglasses.
Velita! Ivre! Velita!
And she too had veins in her neck. He stepped sideways and disappeared deftly into the angriness around him. Inside the car, Amu whirled around and her eyes were angry. She slapped at Rahil's calves, which were the only part of her left in the car to slap. Calves and brown feet in Bata sandals.
Behave yourself, Amu said.
Baby Kochma pulled Rahel down and she landed on the seat with a surprised thump. She thought there'd been a misunderstanding.
It was Velita, she explained with a smile. And he had a flag.
The flag had seemed to her a most impressive piece of equipment, the right thing for a friend to have.
You're a stupid, silly little girl, Amu said.
Her sudden, fierce anger pinned Rahel against the car seat. Rahel was puzzled. Why was Amu so angry? About what?
But it was him, Rahel said.
Shut up, Amu said.
Rahel saw that Amu had a film of perspiration on her forehead and upper lip, and that her eyes had become hard, like marbles, like Papachi's in the Vienna studio photograph. How Papachi's moth whispered in his children's veins.
Baby Kochma rolled up Rahel's window.
Years later, on a crisp fall morning in upstate New York, on a Sunday train from Grand Central to Croton Harmon, it suddenly came back to Rahel. That expression on Amu's face, like a rogue piece in a puzzle, like a question mark that drifted through the pages of a book and never settled at the end of a sentence. That hard marble look in Amu's eyes, the glisten of perspiration on her upper lip, and the chill of that sudden, hurt silence. What had it all meant? The Sunday train was almost empty. Across the aisle from Rahel, a woman with chapped cheeks and a mustache coughed up phlegm and wrapped it in twists of newspaper that she tore off the pile of Sunday papers on her lap. She arranged the little packages in neat rows on the empty seat in front of her, as though she was setting up a phlegm stall. As she worked, she chatted to herself in a pleasant, soothing voice. Memory was that woman on the train. Insane in the way she sifted through dark things in a closet and emerged with the most unlikely ones, a fleeting look, a feeling, the smell of smoke, a windscreen wiper, a mother's marble eyes. Quite sane in the way she left huge tracts of darkness veiled, unremembered. Her co-passenger's madness comforted Rahel. It drew her closer into New York's deranged womb, away from the other more terrible thing that haunted her. A sour metal smell, like steel bus rails, and the smell of the bus conductor's hands from holding them. A young man with an old man's mouth. Outside the train, the Hudson shimmered, and the trees were the red-brown colors of fall. It was just a little cold.
There's a nipple in the air, Larry McCaslin said to Rahel, and laid his palm gently against the suggestion of protest from a chilly nipple through her cotton t-shirt. He wondered why she didn't smile. She wondered why it was that when she thought of home, it was always in the colors of the dark, oiled wood of bolts, in the empty cores of the tongues of flame that flickered in brass lamps. It was Velita, that much Rahel was sure of. She'd seen him. He'd seen her. She'd have known him anywhere, anytime. And if he hadn't been wearing a shirt, she would have recognized him from behind. She knew his back. She'd been carried on it, more times than she could count. It had a light brown birthmark shaped like a pointed dry leaf. He said it was a lucky leaf that made the monsoons come on time. A brown leaf on a black back. An autumn leaf at night. A lucky leaf that wasn't lucky enough. Velita wasn't supposed to be a carpenter. He was called Velita, which means white in Malayalam, because he was so black. His father, Velyapapan, was a Paravan, a toddy tapper. He had a glass eye. He had been shaping a block of granite with a hammer when a chip flew into his left eye and sliced right through it. As a young boy, Velita would come with Velyapapan to the back entrance of the Aymanam house to deliver the coconuts they had plucked from the trees in the compound. Papaji would not allow Paravans into the house. Nobody would. They were not allowed to touch anything that touchables touched. Caste Hindus and caste Christians. Mamachi told Esther and Rahel that she could remember a time in her girlhood when Paravans were expected to crawl backwards with a broom, sweeping away their footprints, so that Brahmins or Syrian Christians would not defile themselves by accidentally stepping into a Paravan's footprint. In Mamachi's time, Paravans, like other untouchables, were not allowed to walk on public roads, not allowed to cover their upper bodies, not allowed to carry umbrellas. They had to put their hands over their mouths when they spoke to divert their polluted breath away from those whom they addressed. When the British came to Malabar, a number of Paravans, Pelayas and Pulayas, among them Velita's grandfather, Kalan, converted to Christianity and joined the Anglican Church to escape the scourge of untouchability. As added incentive, they were given a little food and money. They were known as the Rice Christians. It didn't take them long to realize that they had jumped from the frying pan into the fire. They were made to have separate churches, with separate services and separate priests. As a special favor, they were even given their own separate pariah bishop. After independence, they found they were not entitled to any government benefits like job reservations or bank loans at low interest rates, because officially, on paper, they were Christians and therefore casteless. It was a little like having to sweep away your footprints without a broom, or worse, not being allowed to leave footprints at all. It was Mamachi, on vacation from Delhi and Imperial Entomology, who first noticed little Velita's remarkable facility with his hands. Velita was 11 then, about 3 years younger than Ammu. He was like a little magician. He could make intricate toys, tiny windmills, rattles, minute jewel boxes, out of dried palm reeds. He could carve perfect boats out of tapioca stems and figurines on cashew nuts. He would bring them for Ammu, holding them out on his palm, as he had been taught, so she wouldn't have to touch him to take them. Though he was younger than she was, he called her Ammukutti, little Ammu. Mamachi persuaded Velyapapan to send him to the untouchable school that her father-in-law, Punyankunya, had founded. Velita was 14 when Johann Klein, a German carpenter from a carpenter's guild in Bavaria, came to Kottayam and spent 3 years with the Christian Mission Society conducting a workshop with local carpenters. Every afternoon after school, Velita caught a bus to Kottayam, where he worked with Klein till dusk. By the time he was 16, Velita had finished high school
and was an accomplished carpenter. He had his own set of carpentry tools and a distinctly German design sensibility. He built Mamachi a Bauhaus dining table with 12 dining chairs in rosewood and a traditional Bavarian chaise longue in lighter jackwood. For Baby Kuchma's annual nativity plays, he made her a stack of wire-framed angel's wings that fitted onto children's backs like knapsacks, cardboard clouds for the angel Gabriel to appear between, and a manger for Christ to be born in. When her garden cherub's silver ark dried up inexplicably, it was Dr. Velita who fixed its bladder for her. Apart from his carpentry skills, Velita had a way with machines. Mamachi, with impenetrable touchable logic, often said that if only he hadn't been a Padawan, he might have become an engineer. He mended radios, clocks, water pumps. He looked after the plumbing and all the electrical gadgets in the house. When Mamachi decided to enclose the back veranda, it was Velita who designed and built the sliding folding door that later became all the rage in Imanam. Velita knew more about the machines in the factory than anyone else. When Chako resigned his job in Madras and returned to Imanam with a Bharat bottle sealing machine, it was Velita who reassembled it and set it up. It was Velita who maintained the new canning machine and the automatic pineapple slicer. Velita who oiled the water pump and the small diesel generator. Velita who built the aluminium sheet-lined, easy-to-clean cutting surfaces and the ground-level furnaces for boiling fruit. Velita's father, Velyapapan, however, was an old-world Padawan. He had seen the crawling backwards days, and his gratitude to Mamachi and her family for all that they had done for him was as wide and deep as a river in spate. When he had his accident with the stone ship, Mamachi organized and paid for his glass eye. He hadn't worked off his debt yet, and though he knew he wasn't expected to, that he wouldn't ever be able to, he felt that his eye was not his own. His gratitude widened his smile and bent his back. Velyapapan feared for his younger son. He couldn't say what it was that frightened him. It was nothing that he had said or done. It was not what he said, but the way he said it. Not what he did, but the way he did it. Perhaps it was just a lack of hesitation, an unwarranted assurance in the way he walked, the way he held his head, the quiet way he offered suggestions without being asked, or the quiet way in which he disregarded suggestions without appearing to rebel. While these were qualities that were perfectly acceptable, perhaps even desirable in touchables, Velyapapan thought that in a Padawan they could and would, and indeed should, be construed as insolence. Velyapapan tried to caution Velita, but since he couldn't put his finger on what it was that bothered him, Velita misunderstood his muddled concern. To him it appeared as though his father grudged him his brief training and his natural skills. Velyapapan's good intentions quickly degenerated into nagging and bickering and a general air of unpleasantness between father and son. Much to his mother's dismay, Velita began to avoid going home. He worked late. He caught fish in the river and cooked it on an open fire. He slept outdoors on the banks of the river. Then one day, he disappeared. For 4 years, nobody knew where he was. There was a rumor that he was working on a building site for the Department of Welfare and Housing in Trivandrum, and more recently, the inevitable rumor that he had become a Naxalite, that he had been to prison. Somebody said they had seen him in Kwailon. There was no way of reaching him when his mother, Chella, died of tuberculosis. Then, Kuttapan, his older brother, fell off a coconut tree and damaged his spine. He was paralyzed and unable to work. Velita heard of the accident a whole year after it happened. It had been 5 months since he returned to Imanam. He never talked about where he had been or what he had done. Mamachi rehired Velita as the factory carpenter and put him in charge of general maintenance. It caused a great deal of resentment among the other touchable factory workers because, according to them, Paravans were not meant to be carpenters, and certainly prodigal Paravans were not meant to be rehired. To keep the others happy, and since she knew that nobody else would hire him as a carpenter, Mamachi paid Velita less than she would a touchable carpenter, but more than she would a Paravan. Mamachi didn't encourage him to enter the house, except when she needed something mended or installed. She thought that he ought to be grateful that he was allowed in the factory premises at all, and allowed to touch things that touchables touched. She said that it was a big step for a Paravan. When he returned to Aymanam after his years away from home, Velita still had about him the same quickness, the sureness. And Velyapapa feared for him now more than ever. But this time he held his peace. He said nothing. At least not until the terror took hold of him. Not until he saw, night after night, a little boat being rowed across the river. Not until he saw it return at dawn. Not until he saw what his untouchable son had touched, more than touched, entered, loved. When the terror took hold of him, Velyapapan went to Mamachi. He stared straight ahead with his mortgaged eye. He wept with his own one. One cheek glistened with tears, the other stayed dry. He shook his own head from side to side to side till Mamachi ordered him to stop. He trembled his own body like a man with malaria. Mamachi ordered him to stop it, but he couldn't, because you can't order fear around. Not even a Paravan's. Velyapapan told Mamachi what he had seen. He asked God's forgiveness for having spawned a monster. He offered to kill his son with his own bare hands, to destroy what he had created. In the next room, Baby Kachma heard the noise and came to find out what it was all about. She saw grief and trouble ahead, and secretly, in her heart of hearts, she rejoiced. She said, among other things, "How could she stand the smell? Haven't you noticed they have a particular smell, these Paravans?" And she shuddered theatrically, like a child being force-fed spinach. She preferred an Irish Jesuit smell to a particular Paravan smell, by far. By far. Velita, Velyapapan and Kottappan lived in a little laterite hut downriver from the Aymanam house, a 3-minute run through the coconut trees for Esthappan and Rahel. They had only just arrived in Aymanam with Ammu and were too young to remember Velita when he left, but in the months since he had returned, they had grown to be the best of friends. They were forbidden from visiting his house, but they did. They would sit with him for hours on their haunches, hunched punctuation marks in a pool of wood shavings, and wonder how he always seemed to know what smooth shapes waited inside the wood for him. They loved the way wood, in Velita's hands, seemed to soften and become as pliable as plasticine. He was teaching them to use a planer. His house, on a good day, smelled of fresh wood shavings and the sun, of red fish curry cooked with black tamarind, the best fish curry, according to Esther, in the whole world. It was Velita who made Rahel her luckiest ever fishing rod and taught her and Esther to fish. And on that sky-blue December day, it was him that she saw through her red sunglasses, marching with a red flag at the level crossing outside Cochin. Steel shrill police whistles pierced holes in the noise umbrella. Through the jagged umbrella holes, Rahel could see pieces of red sky. And in the red sky, hot red kites wheeled, looking for rats. In their hooded yellow eyes there was a road and red flags marching. And a white shirt over a black back with a birthmark. Marching. Terror, sweat and talcum powder had blended into a mauve paste between Baby Kutma's rings of neck fat. Spit coagulated into little white gobs at the corners of her mouth. She imagined she saw a man in the procession who looked like the photograph in the newspapers of the Naxalite called Rajan,
who was rumored to have moved south from Palghat. She imagined he had looked straight at her. A man with a red flag and a face like a knot opened Rahel's door because it wasn't locked. The doorway was full of men who'd stopped to stare. "Feeling hot, baby?" the man like a knot asked Rahel kindly in Malayalam. Then unkindly, "Ask your daddy to buy you an air condition." And he hooted with delight at his own wit and timing. Rahel smiled back at him, pleased to have Chako mistaken for her father, like a normal family. "Don't answer," Baby Kachma whispered hoarsely. "Look down, just look down." The man with the flag turned his attention to her. She was looking down at the floor of the car, like a coy, frightened bride who had been married off to a stranger. "Hello, sister," the man said carefully in English. "What is your name, please?" When Baby Kachma didn't answer, he looked back at his co-hecklers. "She has no name." "What about Modalali Mariakutti?" someone suggested with a giggle. Modalali in Malayalam means landlord. "A, B, C, D, X, Y, Z," somebody else said irrelevantly. More students crowded around. They all wore handkerchiefs or printed Bombay-dyeing hand towels on their heads to stave off the sun. They looked like extras who had wandered off the sets of the Malayalam version of Sinbad, The Last Voyage. The man like a knot gave Baby Kachma his red flag as a present. "Here," he said, "hold it." Baby Kachma held it, still not looking at him. "Wave it," he ordered. She had to wave it. She had no choice. It smelled of new cloth and a shop, crisp and dusty. She tried to wave it as though she wasn't waving it. "Now say, Inqilab Zindabad." "Inqilab Zindabad," Baby Kachma whispered. "Good girl." The crowd roared with laughter. A shrill whistle blew. "Okay then," the man said to Baby Kachma in English, as though they had successfully concluded a business deal. "Bye-bye." He slammed the sky blue door shut. Baby Kachma wobbled. The crowd around the car unclotted and went on with its march. Baby Kachma rolled the red flag up and put it on the ledge behind the back seat. She put her rosary back into her blouse, where she kept it with her melons. She busied herself with this and that, trying to salvage some dignity. After the last few men walked past, Chako said it was all right now to roll down the windows. "Are you sure it was him?" Chako asked Rahel. "Who?" Rahel said, suddenly cautious. "Are you sure it was Velita?" Rahel said, playing for time, trying to decipher Esther's frantic thought signals. "I said, are you sure that the man you saw was Velita?" Chako said for the third time.
Yes.
Almost," Rahel said.
"You're almost sure?" Chako said.
"No, it was almost Velita," Rahel said. "It almost looked like him."
"So you're not sure then?"
"Almost not." Rahel slid a look at Esther for approval. "It must have been him," Baby Kachma said. "It's Trivandrum that's done this to him. They all go there and come back thinking they're some great politicos." Nobody seemed particularly impressed by her insight. "We should keep an eye on him," Baby Kachma said. "If he starts this union business in the factory, I've noticed some signs, some rudeness, some ingratitude. The other day I asked him to help me with the rocks for my scree bed, and he..."
"I saw Velita at home before we left," Esther said brightly. "So how could it be him?"
"For his own sake," Baby Kachba said darkly. "I hope it wasn't. And next time, Estapen, don't interrupt."
She was annoyed that nobody asked her what a scree bed was. In the days that followed, Baby Kachma focused all her fury at her public humiliation on Velita. She sharpened it like a pencil. In her mind, he grew to represent the march. And the man who had forced her to wave the Marxist party flag. And the man who christened her Modalali Mariakutti,
and all the men who had laughed at her. She began to hate him. From the way Amu held her head, Rahel could tell that she was still angry. Rahel looked